ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 12th of April. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Very few people have risen so high or fallen so far as former American football star O.J. Simpson. He's died overnight from cancer, surrounded by family. As an NFL player and then an actor, he was a household name in America. Then his 1995 trial for the murder of his ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend captivated and divided the nation before he was controversially acquitted. He was later jailed on unrelated charges of armed robbery. Here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
O.J. Simpson first came to fame as an extraordinarily talented athlete. He won the Heisman Trophy, awarded to the best college American football player, in 1968 before graduating to the NFL, breaking records as a running back and retiring a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, well, you know, that spontaneous reaction from a crowd, right. I know I'm going to miss that. I think the thing I miss the most is, you know, as players, you can get in the locker room, you get to know each other so well that you can really act silly, you know? Yeah. You can go in every day and act silly and have a good time. And
with his athletic prowess and natural charisma, he also became a big deal off the field, landing lucrative endorsements and building an acting career, one of the first black athletes to be fully embraced by white America. But his life took a shocking twist when his former wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ron Goldman, were found brutally murdered. Both had been repeatedly stabbed. Nicole also had her throat slit. Simpson quickly became the prime suspect, and the live coverage of police pursuing his white Ford Bronco through Los Angeles became one of the defining moments of the 1990s.
...of the vehicle was on the cellular phone. We believe that the passenger is O.J. Simpson.
His trial for the two murders was broadcast to millions, becoming a cultural touchstone. People tuned in as his legal team tried to rip apart the prosecutor's case, including accusations of racism and a bizarre moment where O.J. appeared to struggle to pull on a pair of gloves linked to the murders. Johnny Cochran's famous line in closing arguments itself became a meme.
It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
He was acquitted by the jury, but not by the public at large. Polling suggests the majority of Americans believed he'd gotten away with murder. He was sued by the parents of both Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman and was found liable for their deaths, ordered to pay $33.5 million in restitution, although he never paid the full amount. He was later sentenced to 33 years for the kidnapping and robbery of a Las Vegas memorabilia dealer. After serving 9, he was released. From a beloved sporting figure to a man accused of horrific acts of violence, he lived out his final years in infamy. This is Carrington Clark in Washington, reporting for AM.
There was global outrage after the head of Spanish football, Luis Rubiales, kissed star player Jenny Hermoso on the lips without consent at the World Cup in Australia last year. Spanish prosecutors have now detailed an alleged timeline of harassment and intimidation in the days that followed by the most powerful figures in Spanish football. The court documents claim Hermoso was repeatedly pressured to publicly say the kiss was consensual, and when that didn't work, they turn to her family. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports from London.
The World Cup is the domain of Spain.
Winning the World Cup final in Australia was one of Spain's finest moments in sport, but it was overshadowed by an unsolicited kiss that drew open the curtain on systemic sexism, not just in Spanish sport, but society in general, sparking a public reckoning. Estela Cortez is a sexual assault lawyer in Spain.
It was very shocking by the Spanish people because we can justify it as an abuse, we can justify it as an aggression, but it's something that it's not right. So obviously the Spanish people doesn't agree at all.
AM has obtained court documents which lay out an alleged timeline of intense harassment and intimidation. From the moment Hermoso left the presentation stage, the Spanish public prosecutor alleges Rubiales and his executive team repeatedly pressured Hermoso to make a public statement that the kiss was consensual. When she refused, attention shifted to her family. It's claimed then-coach of the Spanish women's team, Jorge Vilda, approached Damoso's brother on the return flight and warned him if she didn't agree to their demands, there would be personal and professional consequences. The harassment allegedly followed her on a team trip to Ibiza. Despite social media videos showing Damoso appearing in good spirits behind closed doors, senior management are accused of keeping the pressure on. When she wouldn't engage, they started intimidating her friend in person and in WhatsApp messages. One said Damoso was a bad person and wished her to be very lonely in life. Marta Soler-Gallart is a professor of sociology at the University of Barcelona.
It shows how much it is in our society, but also how institutions protect this kind of behaviour because of the institutional power.
Rubiales and the three other men deny all the allegations. Prosecutors are seeking 2 years and 6 months prison for Rubiales. Spain's tough new sexual assault laws mean there's a real prospect he could face jail time. This is Catherine Dis in London, reporting for AM.
Ukraine has passed a controversial bill to boost troop numbers as it struggles to fill its ranks in the fight against Russia. Cayman Gock reports from London.
On the streets of Kyiv, Ukrainian women gather in protest. These mothers, sisters and daughters wanted a limit on service in Ukraine's armed forces. Some have loved ones who've been fighting for more than 2 years. But that won't happen. Parliament has now passed a bill that will call on more civilians and there'll be no time limit on their service. Anna's husband is a conscript and says his rights are being diminished.
Of course, I feel despair and disappointment. I know our relatives didn't doubt for a second whether to risk their lives for their country, but the government has been dragging this legislation vote for months.
It comes about a week after Ukraine lowered the draft eligibility age from 27 to 25. The bill also requires men to update their personal details with authorities to make it easier to draft civilians. This addresses an issue draft officers have faced relying on sometimes incomplete and old data. Ukrainian General Yuriy Sodol spoke at Parliament painting a bleak picture on the Eastern Front.
The enemy outnumbers us by 7 to 10 times. We lack manpower. Pass this law, we need it badly. We are holding the defences, but we are on our last breath.
Meanwhile, Russia has been ramping up its bombardment on Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. On Thursday, a major power plant near the capital was destroyed by an airstrike. Kyiv says Moscow used more than 80 missiles and drones. Ukraine continues to appeal for urgent aid from the West, including for Patriots, a US-made air defence system. Here's President Volodymyr Zelensky.
We won't need Patriot systems forever. We will definitely be able to produce our own systems. We started working on this. I believe we will be able to do it. But during this time, we don't want to lose people.
Ukraine, a country beset by shortages in munitions and soldiers.
Cayman Gock there. Well, there's been some pushback from industry groups to the Albanese government's announcement of a Future Made in Australia plan to compete on the world stage in the manufacture of green technology. The Productivity Commission warns it could create an ongoing net cost for government while diverting resources away from other parts of the economy where they might generate higher value. Speaking on 7:30 last night, the Prime Minister outlined two scenarios for government intervention.
One of the things that we are looking at is areas of identifying two different motives, if you like, for intervention. One is where Australia has a comparative advantage. The second is where our national sovereignty matters.
Angus Taylor is the Shadow Treasurer. He joined me earlier. Angus Taylor, thanks for being with us. This is ultimately a plan to bring manufacturing back to Australia. Will the Coalition come up with an alternative plan to do that? Or are you conceptually against this at its heart?
Well, David, we all want to see more manufacturing in Australia. That was a big focus for me when we were in government. It's been a big focus of my career before coming into government to strengthen Australian manufacturing. And that will be a strong focus for us in the lead up to the election, and it is now. But you get there by focusing on the fundamentals: affordable, reliable energy, getting approvals done in a timely way, making sure that we've got a competitive industrial relations system where union officials aren't able to unnecessarily, in an untoward way, call the shots. That's how you do it. It's on the fundamentals. Now, the fear we have with this MIA bill is that it will indeed be inflationary. It won't solve the manufacturing challenges we've got. It's a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. And we're already seeing that an equivalent sort of set of interventions that have been made in the United States in the last 24 hours, that sort of stimulus is driving up inflation. Mm. The US is now seeing inflation rising, prices rising sharply.
Just on that inflation point, I mean, this Future Made in Australia plan isn't a dump of money in the economy now. It's tax incentives and subsidies sometime in the future when the economy, we're told, will need stimulus. So is inflation really that much of a concern?
Well, that tells me that the government thinks that the inflation problem has been solved. I think we're far from that. But right now, Australia.
But this isn't a plan for now. That's what I mean.
Well, when is it for?
Well, I mean, this is the future made in Australia. It's for the future, I guess.
well, when is the future, David? I mean, the whole point about this is it's very long on spin. I read the Prime Minister's speech. It's very long on spin and very short on detail. You can't name the time when the stimulus is going to hit.
Well, we'll know more at the budget.
What I do know is he's using the analogy of the US bill. The US bill is stimulating their economy right now, and it's driving inflation, and it's driving it in a way which wasn't expected. Right now, the number one issue Australians are facing is a cost of living crisis. This in no way is a solution to the cost of living crisis. Indeed, it will exacerbate it. And if we want strong manufacturing in this country, and we do, we need to get back to the fundamentals of affordable, reliable energy, flexible industrial relations, that delivers higher real wages and competitive workplaces at the same time as approvals and deregulation that encourages businesses to invest, to take risks, to employ, to drive competitiveness and productivity. They're the fundamentals that have worked historically, and they're the fundamentals that will work in the future.
Would you support a tightening of rules around sovereignty for critical minerals to ensure that we retain control of these important supply chains?
Yeah, that's an important issue, and it's one that has to be obviously done with our partners around the world. And that's a very general proposition, so you have to look at the specifics of it, individual proposals. I mean, making sure that we've got supply chains that we can trust in critical areas, particularly for areas like defence, obviously that's important. It's always been important, David. But this is about much more than that. The risk with what Albanese is talking about here is that it ends up as a big pot of money to pay back his union paymasters. And the concern here is that it's hard-earned taxpayers' money used in an inappropriate way and in a way which risks driving inflation higher for longer, which is exactly what we're seeing in the United States.
Just on another matter, do you think it was reasonable for Peter Dutton to compare the Port Arthur massacre to the Opera House protest after October 7 to make a point about the need for governments to seize important moments?
Well, it's very important that people who comment on this speech read the speech. It was a clarion call that we've got to stand up against the rising tide of anti-Semitism in the country, which is something that Prime Minister has failed to do.
But did he Peter go Dutton too far with that comparison?
Let me get to that. Peter Dutton was pointing out the fact that John Howard showed the moral leadership that was needed in the wake of Port Arthur. But Anthony Albanese has been weak. He has wavered in our support for the Jewish community here in the wake of the 7th of October, the greatest slaughter of Jews since the Second World War, a truly tragic and terrible event, and especially in the wake of terrible protests outside the Sydney Opera House on the 9th of October. So the call here is for moral leadership, and I don't think we have seen that from Anthony Albanese.
Angus Taylor, thank you.
Good on you. Thanks, David.
Angus Taylor is the Shadow Treasurer. Voters in former Prime Minister Scott Morrison's seat of Cook will choose his successor this weekend. But so far, it seems the by-election to elect a new local member isn't exactly electrifying the people of Cook, with the Australian Electoral Commission voicing concern about the prospect of a low turnout tomorrow. Nick Grimm visited the electorate to gauge the mood.
Excuse me, mate. Hi, I'm from ABC Radio. We're just asking people, are you getting very excited about this weekend's by-election?
Yeah, right. Okay, that's the first I'm hearing of it. Didn't even know it was on.
I didn't even know there was one on, so there you go.
If these voters in the southern Sydney suburb of Gymea are any guide, the Cook by-election has remained well under their radar.
Isn't it compulsory to vote?
It sure is, yeah.
Yeah, so there you go.
Definitely be going down to vote then. Don't want to get in trouble. I don't know anyone that's really into politics or really cares.
I don't think the younger generation takes politics maybe as seriously as maybe they should.
But to be fair, it appears it's not just Cook's younger voters feeling a little unmotivated about the by-election, triggered by the resignation of former Prime Minister and local member Scott Morrison, who's held the seat in Sydney's Sutherland Shire since 2007. The Australian Electoral Commission says early voting in the seat is down by more than 11% on the turnout for the last federal election. It's down by almost 13% when compared to last year's voice referendum. Postal vote applications are also lower than expected.
Unfortunately, I don't think people have much interest.
Does that surprise you that there's a low level of interest this time?
In this electorate, not really. I think it's almost a foregone conclusion.
And there's not much choice.
Why do you say that?
Because there's only a Liberal candidate.
I don't think Labor had a candidate, so that sort of says it all, really.
But will a low voter turnout in the safe Liberal seat hold any omens for the major parties in the lead-up to the next federal election?
Yeah, you can never tell in these contests who stays at home, who doesn't turn out, whose base doesn't turn out. Is it the Liberal base? Is it the Labor base? Is it the Greens?
Tony Barry is a former Liberal Party strategist at the state and federal level, now director of the political communications organisation, the Redbridge Group.
Because there's no Labor Party candidate in the race, it's quite possible that Labor's base might be coming out. You'd expect the Greens to be the beneficiary. The last election, they got around 9% of the vote, 9.9% of the vote. With Labor not in the race this time, their primary vote should be around 30 points.
That's former Liberal Party strategist Tony Barry, Nick Grimm with that report. Housing is one of the most acute pressure points for state and federal governments, and analysts say the target of 1.2 million new homes by 2029 is unlikely to be met. The building industry is being squeezed by labour shortages and inflated material costs, and it isn't keeping up with demand. Countless companies have already gone broke, and some smaller builders are even selling their own private homes just to stay in business. John Daly reports.
This is around about a $500,000 build. I would say probably 4 or 5 years ago, it would have been a $300,000 build.
Perth builder Jason Jansen considers himself one of the lucky ones. His business has just made it through these last few years, but not without some scars.
Stressful and depressing, to be perfectly honest. We've lost a significant amount of money. We're lucky enough that we've come through the other side, but not without battle scars. We've had to sell assets to keep paying the bills.
Mr. Jansen also heads the Home Builders Action Group, which advocates for WA's builders. Now, 6 home builders in the state have gone into administration in the last 6 weeks, and more than 100 others went under last financial year. It's a very similar story in other states, and that's largely because building costs have blown out by almost 28% since the pandemic, with some materials like timber jumping up to 70%.
Nostradamus couldn't have actually seen the price increases escalating to that level.
Jason Jansen says lenders won't touch builders because of these steep losses.
So, John, in many cases, I've heard a lot of builders have actually been forced to sell their own homes to pay for price increases as they can't access funds from the banks.
The federal government wants to build 1.2 million new homes by mid-2029, starting this coming financial year. The latest ABS data shows only 171,000 new homes were built last year, 70,000 homes short of the pace needed to reach that target. CoreLogic economist Caitlin Ezzie says there are some encouraging signs that construction costs are starting to level out, though.
So since the onset of COVID, we've seen construction costs rise by about 28%. But over the past year, that's sort of normalised down to around a 3% rise.
But there's now another problem. Caitlin Ezzie says new detached dwelling approvals, reflecting the number of people willing to invest in a build, are falling way behind too.
And in fact, in January, we saw approvals for detached houses reached an 11.5-year low, with only 7,500 new properties approved for construction.
Caitlin Ezzie says interest rate rises are weighing heavily on people's willingness to invest.
John Daly reporting, and that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For decades, music festivals have been a big deal, attracting millions of revelers. But the appeal seems to be dying away, with a string of cancellations this year. Today, Double J's national music correspondent, Zan Rowe, on whether the big music festival can be saved. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.